This is The Conversation. It's episode 130 with Jennifer Sullivan, New York-based artist, including painting, video, performing, and comedy. She does it all. I am Michael Shaw. The website for this show is theconversationpod.com, where you can check out images that go along with this episode and videos. I highly, highly recommend you check out particularly Soliloquy, which is an awesome short video that Jen Sullivan has up on Vimeo, and it's something we refer to and use as a launching pad to talk about many different things, very personal with her, including her dating life, her analysis, and so on. And I'm really grateful for how open she was in this conversation, and I think it's makes for a superb episode, you don't mind my tooting our horn here. Before we get there, just a couple of quick things. One is the last episode, 129, was with Helen Toomer, the director of the Pulse New York and Miami Fairs. The New York Pulse Fair is still going on as we speak, among the other Armory Art Week fairs. Before we get to talking to Jennifer Sullivan, I wanted to let you know that one of the supporters of the show, Artillery Magazine, has just come out with their March-April issue. It's on newsstands both around Los Angeles galleries and also at the art fairs if you happen to still be in New York. Grab one there, or of course you can go to the website artillerymag.com. The issue is focused on sculpture, and just give you a little sneak preview. One of the articles is called The Death of Sculpture. So if that's not a teaser, I don't know what is. All right, let's get to that conversation with Jennifer Sullivan. Thank you very much for being here. I have a little bit of news and announcing to do on the back end, so I hope you will stay around for that. Thank you very much for being here. I'll talk to you then. So you are in Ridgewood as we speak, Ridgewood, Queens, I should say, as we speak, correct?
Yes.
Where is that in Queens?
It's near-ish to Bushwick. But my part, I like to call it Deep Ridgewood because it's a little more like old school. Like it hasn't really been gentrified yet.
Mm-hmm. Is that
the part that touches Brooklyn is a bit more like starting to have some galleries and hipster coffee shops and things like that.
But you're in the part that doesn't touch Brooklyn.
Yes. Yeah, my part is.
And is that why you're there? Because it's a little bit more affordable, if you don't mind my asking?
Yeah, definitely. That's how I was not aware of the neighborhood before I moved here like 6 years ago. And I live alone and I have a live work. So it's like it's a kind of a crazy deal. So I've been here like a long time now.
Did you find it through a classified situation or somebody you know or?
No, it's like I guess it's not illegal, but I'm not supposed to have a stove, but I think everyone on the block kind of has living situation, like a zoning thing, but my friends live upstairs from me and my apartment kind of came with their apartment. So it's like a semi-basement apartment. Like it does have some windows, but
right.
It's like a little quirky, but it's pretty great also.
Well, if it's the same place as the one that I remember seeing an image of with the street right outside, it looks fairly nice. Is that the same place?
No, yeah, I'm very fond of it. Like, it's actually my favorite neighborhood that I've lived in, and I'm kind of like, I've called myself like the mayor of Ridgewood at times because
right.
I guess an early adopter, and I'm
right.
Actually even gave a tour of Ridgewood once. Where
wow.
Someone paid me, and there's just like lots of little, like Houdini's grave is right nearby, and I've like used that in a video before, and I don't know, it's just like there's a lot of charming little eccentric things.
Now the funny hole, which I heard about, I think from somebody else first, if I remember right, but is that in Ridgewood or is that in another part of Queens?
No, yeah, that's in Ridgewood, too. It's like a 10-minute walk from my apartment
right.
And my friends.
And it was already there. Was it already there when you moved there or since you moved to the area?
Well, my friends were living there Well, I mean, I met them, I guess, through living in Ridgewood, but they are a couple, Andrea Burgard and Joe Balawag, and they own a building there. Mm-hmm. And so the funny hole is just like their basement, but it happens to be like this beautiful, like kind of speakeasy almost. Like it has a real bar and it has these murals, and it's like not actually a real comedy club, but it's just like an intermittent thing that we call the funny hole.
Oh, okay. So actually, if you go there on a Tuesday evening, you know, you're not going to see a big logo of funny hole.
Okay, no, we have shows maybe like, I think there's been maybe 5 to 6 shows total. And I've been involved, like they had asked me initially, like it was their idea actually to do this. And they had asked me because they knew that was kind of my like wheelhouse, but I was feeling too busy initially. But then I went and I was like, oh, I want to do this. And now it's like really kind of been a cool thing that's been happening.
Mm. When I first heard about who you, you know, you the artist and some of the descriptions of you, the fact that you have been doing performances as Julian Schnabel and in some cases along with his family members is the way it was put to me. That really jumped out at me because he's a real lightning rod of a figure, I think. And you showed me, you shared with me, a relatively recent performance with you playing Schnabel and then a much taller dude playing Vito, his son. How many though performances have you done as him?
Well, yeah, Max is the person who was the Vito Schnabel character, and that was the first time we did it together. I think I've done it now 4 times.
Okay.
I think I've done it 4 times.
And has this gone viral enough to get on his radar, or are you confined to the boroughs?
I'm really curious. Yeah. Uh-huh. I have no idea, but I know that he's not like there's people who totally have met him and like hung out with him that I know, I guess, and like, so I don't know. I don't know if he would be offended or what. Like,
right?
I even like named my show in LA kind of after him. It was called Big Girl Paintings. Like, I mean, mm-hmm. I didn't perform there, but I have had a kind of love-hate thing for him for a while now.
Yeah. Yeah, when I first started reading about him, because there, you know, was a ton of press on him, you know, especially around the height of his career back, I guess, in the latter 80s. Yeah, I was kind of, it was about sort of wading through the noise of everybody's different opinions and trying to figure out what was really going on there. And I'd say that I've wound up feeling like, he's a pretty good filmmaker, but I have a hard time ultimately with his art. And I wonder what part of him you love.
Well, I actually like a lot of his art. Not all of it. Like, I think some of it's like awful, but I think some of it really speaks to me also, mm-hmm. just at least on a like material level. But I feel like, but his persona probably more than anything is what kind of like got under my skin. Like, mm-hmm. I once saw an interview with him on Charlie Rose, which I have not been able to find since after like thinking about it later on, but I just like, it really upset me because he just seemed like he never doubted himself like once in his whole life. And I just like could not relate to that at all. And it made me feel very like, it made me feel like, I mean, I feel like I've been struggling to kind of get to a place of like realizing my dreams. And I felt like maybe I was lacking something that I needed that he had like in spades or something. And I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Well, the thing that makes me think of is, you know, when an artist either falls in love with or becomes really impressed, influenced by an artist, mm-hmm. there's that danger of worst case scenario, meeting them and finding out they're a total asshole. But even before that, you know, just like you did, seeing an interview and going, wow, that's really not what I wanted to hear or see. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, I think the performance grew out of I think also I take issue with his ego in a lot of ways, but I also admire it. And so the performance was kind of a way to both kind of make fun of that, which is kind of he's just the most kind of caricature of male privilege or something. And I was kind of taking that on, but also and trying to kind of inhabit it also and try it on for myself and maybe feel what that's like a little bit.
Do you think you're a more confident, bombastic person now that you've been inhabiting him for a little while now?
No, I think I'm always working on that, and I'm very into self-help and stuff. And one of the performances I did as him was kind of framed as a confidence building seminar.
Mm-hmm.
But no, I mean, it's fun to kind of be that character. I don't think it's changed me deeply or something.
Right. Well, maybe it's still a little early, you know, you need to do a few more.
Get
a few more performances under your inflated belt, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely weird to be, I feel I don't know, I've had this thing of I talk about in one of my videos about being cute and being perceived as cute, and I have this high voice and stuff, and I don't try to change my voice when I do the character.
I feel
it's kind of a mixture between us or something,
right,
or it's
right.
Obviously I'm not him in a way also.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if you don't mind my asking, since you mentioned your voice, is that, we could talk a little bit about what kind of experiences you've had. I mean, whether people have said anything overtly to you, or you have gotten sort of in the mind of anticipating or interpreting, you know, people's reaction to you and your through your voice in certain cases.
Yeah, I guess, I mean, I've gotten a lot of response to it over the years. I think it's kind of evolved as I've gotten older. And I'm a teacher now and stuff. And
mm-hmm.
I think in the past, I feel I've experienced a lot of condescension or an assumption that I'm younger than I am.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like I kind of expect that at times now, but I feel like it's also, I feel like I get it less the more older and more confident I am in myself, but I definitely still, I feel like it's kind of a tool I use though also. I think in some ways my comedy or my self-awareness that my voice is comical in some way is something I'm aware of and try to utilize.
Mm-hmm.
And I've done a lot of voiceover in my videos and stuff.
Right. My sense though, meanwhile, is from watching a few of your performances is whether it's the audio quality, you know, being in a performance space and or being confident, you know, in your performance, that your voice, your register actually seems like it goes down a little bit.
Room. I mean, it does definitely fluctuate, mm-hmm. I would say, mm-hmm. in different situations. I think a lot of my performance actually grew out of I feel like my default performance persona in a way is kind of a satire of myself. The qualities I see people seeing in me of ditzy or something like that.
Right.
I feel like I play it up when I perform.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the thing that I keep thinking about in relation to this voice thing is the performance where you play sort of a talk show host and you invite three candidates to go on a date with you up on stage. One of whom turns out to be a woman, and two dudes, and then one dude wins. And I'd be interested to hear how that date went. But before maybe we get to that, I guess I want to point out also that in this other recent video soliloquy, which is basically your sort of video personal ad and satire, which we can get to in a second. But what happened with the date with that guy, or did it happen at all?
It didn't happen at all. I feel like, yeah. I mean, I didn't necessarily expect that it would really lead to that. Although, I mean, I'm totally open to it in a way. But I didn't feel a super, like, spark with this person. And he never, like, actually tried to take me up on it. So, yeah, I didn't. I think, and I had kind of attempted that premise once a long time ago in a kind of, I was doing a podcast kind of thing a long time ago that was actually, I did have a kind of actual talk show performance I used to do called It's a Process.
Mm-hmm.
And so I feel like.
What was the process?
It's called It's the Process, and it was a talk show that where I talked to other artists about their process, kind of. But it was also a live thing, and it was very improvisational. Like, it wasn't very pre-planned, and it was kind of silly and stuff. And so it was a lot of, like, thinking on my feet, and I would do a lot of audience participation and stuff. So in a way, it was, like, that dating thing is kind of a throwback in a way to that or something.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I like kind of reacting to stuff I don't know what's going to happen. And, like, I find that enjoyable in performance, definitely.
Mm-hmm. I'm interested, meanwhile, in, even though this was just ultimately kind of a performance, literally, in that you didn't end up going on the date with the winner, quote unquote, of the contest. But I am interested in your, the underneath, the real here, which is your dating life, since you, you know, obviously work with it in your work, or put it out there in your work. Can we talk about that?
Yeah, totally. It's definitely, I feel like actually my comedy has kind of dovetailed with being single. Like,
mm-hmm.
I mean, I've been performing with a kind of, I've used humor in my work for like years, but the actually taking on the stand-up format and the Julian Schnabel stuff and all that, like the stuff that I do that's not Julian Schnabel is like pretty much doing stand-up about my dating life and being single and stuff. And it's been really, I'm a person who has mostly had boyfriends my whole adult life. And so being single has been really something very challenging to me, but which I'm getting more, like, I feel like I'm most comfortable I've ever been with it right now, but it's been a real source of like struggle. And I feel like I've wanted to kind of talk about it in my work, I think, especially because it's, I don't know, there's a lot of kind of baggage and assumptions in the culture about being single, I think, especially for women. And I've gotten a really good response. Like, I feel like it's been good to like share these things that maybe I wouldn't want to talk about in a regular conversation, but I'm like telling them to a room full of people in a funny way and kind of having power over it or something.
Right. Can you give me the first thing that comes to mind when it, in regards to sharing with the audience, you know, something funny about that state
well,
that you're in?
The first real like stand-up that I did that wasn't a character was called Vagina Monologue, and it was about, it was kind of starts off kind of talking about how I haven't had sex in a long time, and then it goes into this thing about, which is a real story about how I like accidentally left a tampon in and I didn't know it, and which is like kind of a horrifying, embarrassing thing, but it was like very empowering to kind of use it as comedic material. So I've done a lot of vagina jokes and just like, yeah, like I was doing like a PSA for my vagina and stuff in one of them. And the soliloquy video is like,
can I set that up for a second?
Yeah.
People will want to watch this for sure, but just to sort of flesh it out a little bit more. There's a couple versions of you. One, you know, wearing a scarf and sunglasses, sitting by a lake, right? And then there's a sort of pop up image of you talking, if I remember right. And then your yeah. phone number, your mobile phone number, is like in kind of vintage video graphic effects, kind of bouncing along the screen at a certain point. So just to give people a little tiny taste of it before you talk more about it.
Yeah. And I'm wearing, in the kind of inset version of me,
mm-hmm.
I'm wearing a wedding veil also.
Right, right.
Which I thought just kind of amped up the like pathetic quality or something. Like,
mm-hmm.
I mean, I feel like it's actually kind of a dark video when I think about it now. Like, I'm not sure. It's supposed to be funny, but I feel like when I think about it now, it feels quite dark to me. And I mean, I think it's also, I needed to make it when I was on a residency on this kind of semi-private island this summer, and I was in a kind of very dark place when I was there. It was just like lonely kind of, and I mean, it was great. Also, it was amazing for work, but it was also, I feel like I was really grappling with loneliness while I was there. And, and there was really no outlet. Like, there was no real way to even meet anyone besides the people I was there with.
Yeah. Well, so how many other people were on the residency?
There's only two other people, and they're women. And then there's two men who run it, and everyone was in a relationship except for me.
Did the other people have their partners there?
Sometimes, not all the time, but they were in and out of visiting there and stuff.
Right,
and,
right. So it amplified your singleness, I guess.
Yeah, and I had just gone through a kind of really difficult thing with, like, someone I tried to get back together with, an ex, and that had kind of been a huge mess and stuff. So it's just, like, really kind of had to kind of deal with all this stuff, and there was not a lot of distraction also. And so I think it was very cathartic, but I like the idea of using like that as material, and like the idea of like humor as being like a triumph over pain or something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, it is. I mean, I hear you from the dark perspective. I'm sure that's much more of your experience, you know, than the viewers,
yeah.
Because it's definitely very funny. And I think the fact that it's on, we can't minimize the fact that it's on Vimeo as opposed to say YouTube, because it probably has a much more finite audience, and you know, you're not going to get sort of errant or, you know, prank calls or what have you from your phone number,
yeah.
There, right?
I haven't gotten a single phone call that I know of, even though the number's in there. It's gotten a fair amount of views and stuff, and
right.
It's been in the show.
Uh-huh.
But, yeah. I mean, I definitely feel like I was trying to kind of use, like, I feel like I try to use a sense of awkwardness.
Mm-hmm.
And it's always like a little more awkward than I even intended to be, I feel like.
No, I don't think so, actually. I'm gonna have to disagree with you. Yeah, because I think you are both vulnerable and empowering yourself at the same time by saying, I have enough confidence to make myself this vulnerable.
Yeah, I mean, I think that is kind of my whole thing, is like vulnerability as strength. So that's nice. Like,
that's your shtick, Jennifer?
Yeah. I mean, it's been very healing doing these comedy nights. Like, people are always extremely like open afterwards. Like, they want to share embarrassing things about themselves.
Right.
And like,
right.
Feels really good and positive.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And, you know, sort of a question that lingers for me kind of on the in the background or on the sideline about these comedy shows is, and you kind of implied it, I think, with what you just said, is that I imagine it's a pretty supportive crowd. And if you were to take that one of your routines, particularly your vagina routine, to an open mic mm-hmm. type situation, that it would maybe be a little bit trickier. Would you agree?
Yeah, I definitely think it would be trickier. I mean, people have been saying I should, like, people have been suggesting I could do real comedy if I want to. And I don't think I actually want to. Like, I think I want to do it in an art context, pretty mm-hmm. much only.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think it would be a lot more challenging to do it in a real comedy situation.
Yeah.
But I do go see, like, I see comedy live, and I am kind of obsessed with stand-up, and I listen to and watch it all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm definitely, like, a student of it or something.
So it's still, it kind of demands the question of being that you are, you know, passionate about comedy and you have been doing comedy, though in an art context, that you mm-hmm. would at least go through with the potentially, you know, painful or scary step of doing it in a comedy club.
Yeah, maybe I should. I mean, to be honest, it's already incredibly scary. I feel like I've been getting, like, it's not at all, in a way, I feel like I started to do performance because it scared me, and it's never really stopped scaring me. Like, I
right.
feel nauseous the day of a performance, and I have to really, really work hard to, like, control it. And
yeah.
then I feel amazing afterwards, but, like, leading up to it is incredibly challenging, I have
yeah.
to say.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But
I hear you.
But, you know, I would definitely not rule it out. I probably should at least give it a try at some time.
I wonder if, speaking more about your performance, because of the vagina monologue that I saw, the video of, you definitely, you know, when you're, after you've gotten through all that, you know, all those butterflies that you've probably been carrying all day, that when you're up on stage, it appears that you're pretty comfortable or confident. And I know that because you're not rushing, you know, you're allowing the moments between, you know, one line and the next to play out.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. I feel like each time I do it, I'm more and more relaxed while I'm doing it, which mm-hmm. is a nice feeling. Like, yeah, I would love to kind of, I've been actually thinking about doing hypnosis to see if I could, like, just, because the nausea is quite intense, and I would love to not have to, it's just another layer of
right.
something to deal with when
yeah.
you're trying to prepare. And
yeah.
So I don't know. Like, I was reading that John Lennon would, like, throw up before his performances and stuff. So I know it's not even
right.
so strange necessarily, but it is irritating, kind of.
Yeah. So this is this is classic. I mean, not that I'm, you know, a clinical psychologist, but this is classic performance-induced anxiety, right? I mean, I imagine that if you're doing, you know, some kind of public speaking, aside from your teaching, that it doesn't induce anything, let alone this kind of, right, nausea.
I don't know. I actually have definitely experienced it. I mean, it doesn't stop me from doing it, which I feel proud of, but
mm-hmm.
like,
mm-hmm.
and I don't think people necessarily know it. I mean, I think there's been times when it may be more apparent than others, and I used to, like, when I first started teaching, the first day of class would always give me a lot of anxiety. But teaching has helped a lot, because I have to talk to this kind of audience that might not even be that interested, you know, like
mm-hmm.
these blank faces are, like, I feel like I'm actually a good teacher, but it's sometimes really hard to tell what students are thinking, and that's been, in a way, a good, like, training ground.
What's the school you're teaching at?
SUNY Old Westbury. It's a college in Long Island.
What part of Long Island?
Jericho. It's like not that a drive there. It's like a 40-minute drive with no traffic, but often there's traffic. And And my kids are very, like, sheltered. Like, they're not art students, so that's another layer of some challenge or something.
Yeah,
I mean,
so
I think it's...
I was just going to say, I imagine that the blank faces have a lot to do with minimal to no exposure to contemporary art, perhaps?
Yeah, and I have to start at zero, kind of. But I feel like I've been realizing I am getting through to them more than it might seem initially or something. Like, a lot of them seem to really enjoy the class if their student evaluations are any indication.
So right.
It's been good.
Okay, got it. Well, going back to where we started, where I mentioned that I had heard about you doing the Shinalba performances, I also heard or read from our mutual acquaintance that you are rather critical of the art world, and I'd be curious to know how you would describe that and how that manifests.
Oh, really? I'm kind of surprised. I mean, that I don't know that I have thought of myself in that way. I mean, I guess the Julian character is kind of a critique of this, like, I don't know, I guess, you know, rich and egotistical man.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know if I'm like, I mean, I definitely think the art world can be weird and like seamstery and stuff. And I feel like there's definitely weird experiences where people like, have a sense of how important you are or not important and treat you accordingly. And that is a weird thing.
Yeah, but I describe it as the where you are in the hierarchical chain phenomenon, you know, that you're sort of always being pointed out kind of where you are, especially at least if you're a sensitive person, you know, you perceive this maybe even when it's not necessarily there.
Yeah, and I think it can be weird to like, I definitely have noticed myself being intimidated by people who kind of who feel themselves to be more powerful, you know,
right,
or that I might want to actually be involved with, but who have a kind of weird like zone or hierarchy or whatever it is.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
But I feel like I try not to let it like get me down. Like I feel like I want to be a part of the art world, and I try to maybe create things where I can like make my own space in the art world. Like I think the Funny Hole in a way is like that, or I have a dream to try to do something for Miami that would be like a version of the Funny Hole in Miami, which I feel like could kind of probably make fun of some of the art world stuff that's silly.
Right. Yeah, you know,
but I definitely want to be a part of it too.
Yeah, sure, and you are indeed.
Yeah.
But while I fully support this funny hole in, you know, Miami Basel type of scenario, I also think you should append that with doing a day performance where you put on your Schnabel regalia and parade around the fairs, right?
Oh, that's an interesting idea. I haven't done any of that kind of a thing of like, you know, the intersecting with regular life kind of thing.
Right.
I don't know if I would want to, but it's an interesting idea. I mean, I was reading some like tabloidy kind of stuff about his antics at Miami last year, and also the thing about the person who actually got like knifed and stuff is pretty insane.
Yeah, that made, you know, front page news, I think, even.
Yeah, I mean, and it's horrifying, but I felt like right after it happened, I was also like, oh, that's kind of amazing, like, comedy fodder also, because it's like, just like, they say the art world is cutthroat, but this is
right, it's definitely a source for several lines in your upcoming shows, yes.
Yeah.
You heard it here first, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah.
Where are you from, Jennifer?
I'm from upstate New York near Albany.
Uh-huh.
Like a small town near Albany, but it's like 20 minutes from that city. But both my parents are from Brooklyn. Were born and raised in Brooklyn, so I came to the city a lot.
Oh, okay.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. Got it. Where do you want to go from here? Is there a particular area that you think would be interesting to mine? I mean, the place that I was kind of beginning to get into, but I'm sensing that, you know, you don't want to get too personal about it, is your actual dating life. I mean, you basically talked about it. Let's do it then.
I would love to talk about it. I performed on Friday at this thing, and it was basically like, I've also had this Justin Bieber impression or kind of obsession really, but also an impression.
Mm-hmm.
And so I did a kind of routine that was about being single, and then it segued into a kind of meditation on boyfriend genes.
Mm-hmm.
And I talk about my vagina a little bit, but there's a guy I met recently, and I don't know what's up with it, but he was going to maybe come, and I was very frightened by that.
Like, right.
It just felt like a lot for someone that I don't know that I'm kind of attracted to like get from me, like right off the bat. I don't know. I found it kind of. And then he didn't end up coming, and I kind of told him maybe he shouldn't come. And I don't know what's going to happen with it, but I was relieved that he didn't come. But I feel like all my material pretty much is like has a lot to do with being single, I will say. Maybe not all of it, but I'm like, what am I going to do when I actually start dating someone? Like, I'm not sure what it will become. Like, it'll have to transform.
So basically the story, if I may say it, your sort of romantic story is that you basically had this sort of romantic trajectory where you were in a relationship, it ended, you were in another relationship and so on. And now more recently in the last few years, you've been single for the first time for an extended period. Do I have that right, more or less?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I've been single for almost 2 years now, which is like, I was once single for around this much time, and that was like the first time ever, and it was a huge thing for me. But I feel like I was more like chasing different people, and this time I'm like, I've kind of even had decided to be single as a choice, which I never really had done before.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like I'm starting to feel like I'm ready to date again, but I'm a lot more cautious, and I'm also a person who's been in therapy for like a long time. And I recently started analysis, which is like 3 times a week and laying on the couch and stuff.
It's Freudian, the Freudian version.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, which I think has been awesome. Like, I love it. And I feel like it relates to comedy, actually, in a way of just being comfortable to share any idea that, like, I feel like basically my idea of comedy is just sharing strange ideas that maybe you aren't supposed to share in daily life in some way.
Right.
And being, like, courageous enough to try to see if other people can also identify with that.
Right. I'm kind of thinking that there's this paradox in which you are laying it all on the table, you know, in terms of being single and being vulnerable and, you know, and yet sort of empowering yourself at the same time. And that's kind of exercising, you know, your single demons in a way.
Yeah.
But you also don't want to be sharing that performance with prospective suitors or suitees.
Exactly.
Yeah.
This was really the first time where I had encountered that, like, I don't know, paradox or something. Like, in a way, it's like, it's all about that. But if there's someone who I'm actually interested in, it feels like oversharing or like,
right,
like not having good boundaries, or I don't know. It's just, I don't really want to talk about my vagina with someone that might actually be involved in it that soon in the relationship.
Yeah, that makes sense. So it sounds like you have not been actually pursuing or even putting the open sign up for business in terms of dating, but you're about to.
Yeah.
Is that about right?
I feel like I'm on the cusp, yeah, or I'm starting to feel that way. I also have like a solo show in June, which I want to like focus on, but I feel like that doesn't mean I can't date also. So yeah, I feel like I'm starting to be ready, and I'd like to start like, I mean, I think I'm also trying to like raise my standards for myself, which has been a lot. Like I don't feel, not that I was so like, I don't know, whatever, but I'm trying to like, I want to date men that treat me well and are, you know, nice and healthy themselves and stuff. And so I don't know. It feels a little bit, I don't feel like I've met a lot of people that I'm really interested in, but I guess I also haven't super been looking also.
Right. Is there a particular takeaway, would you say, from the relationships that you've had, like something you recognize that you maybe a type that you've been drawn to that maybe is not ideal, or maybe things that you put up with then that you wouldn't put up with now, or you know what I mean? Any kind of takeaway looking back?
Yeah, definitely. Like depressed artists. I kind of feel like I've always, I mean, my mom was actually bipolar, so I'm sure that is part of it, but I feel like I've only really dated other artists, and they've often had depression issues, and that has often led to the breakdown of the relationship in some way. And so I would love to meet someone who's not depressed and hopefully feels, I mean, I think also maybe I was looking for too much of someone to kind of complete me or something too.
Right.
So I'm feeling like I'm working on trying to feel good on my own and hopefully meet someone else who feels good on their own, and we could like be happy together.
Right. Yeah, and that I think it, in a nutshell, is what's so important about your going through this single phase, you know, is that you know, not having done a lot of it, now you're faced with, okay, I'm alone, who am I? Am I comfortable with myself? And yeah, in theory, certainly you want to be the happy person who is happy with themselves is the ideal, you know, partner.
And I feel like I thought I was, and then I realized when the boyfriend was taken away that I wasn't as happy as I thought I was, because it was kind of propping me up or something in a lot of ways.
Right. That's such a tough...
But now,
yeah.
And so, yeah, but now I feel like I've got... It's not that I mean, I definitely still struggle at times with the being single thing, but I feel like I definitely have kind of gone through a, like, I don't know. I feel like I'm starting to come out the other side of it, where it's like I'm okay with being on my own, and that's like a kind of a major hurdle that I feel good about.
Yeah, and it sounds like the therapy is a big part of that, correct?
Yeah, definitely. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm a major proponent of therapy. Like, I kind of feel like everyone should do it, but I don't know.
I'm a proponent of it too. You know, I guess I don't have that many opportunities to recommend it to people, but I will, given the opportunity, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's really, really, like, I feel like I was a much more depressive person before therapy, and I don't identify, I mean, I would say I'm a pretty emotional person, and especially now during analysis, like, I guess part of the idea of going so frequently is that you stay open more, so I'm like stay open right now, and I So, like, I cry really easily, and my emotions are very close to the surface.
Do you think you're, despite being, you know, very open, that you are have the ability to control it when you need to? Say, if you're on a first date, you know, maybe in the next month or two, you know, and there's some kind of trigger that comes from your date. Would you be able to sort of like clamp it down if you needed to?
I think so. Although I do feel like I have somewhat of an impulse to want to share a lot initially, but I think I see myself as being kind of an open book, and I do it in my art, but I don't think I'm always that way. But perhaps in a romantic situation, I have a more strong desire to share a lot. Quickly, and trying to kind of, and my ideal thing is that I want to try to take it slow now and not do that.
Did you take it a little too fast in past cases?
Yeah, I think it was always kind of a thing where, like, it's like very quickly they're like my boyfriend, and I've like moved in with people very quickly, and it's just like I feel like I realized I'm not really weighing our compatibility, or, you know, that, like, it's just like an instant attraction, and it's like it kind of unfolds and without really examining if this will be good for me or something.
Right. But that's good experience nonetheless.
Yeah, I mean, it's always, the honeymoon phase is always nice, but yeah. I think I've started to realize you don't really know a person until like 6 months in or a year in, or you know, I feel like that's when the other stuff starts to come out.
Yeah. Yeah, and I actually, a recent guest, and I won't call the person's name out because I'll let listeners figure it out for themselves, but they mentioned that they got married after 9 months, I think. And I was surprised, you know, that being that people in the art world are, you know, not so traditional for the most part, that I thought that was surprisingly fast. And in light of your comment, you know, which I agree with, you know, I think that honeymoon, the hardcore honeymoon is like maybe what, the first couple of months, but then sort of the longer term honeymoon is probably a year or more, you know, before the real relationship sort of begins.
And then moving in is like a whole nother ball of wax. I feel like that changes things a lot.
Right.
Like, I feel like I would be very slow. Like, my last boyfriend, we had known each other for years, but we moved in. We met each other, and then, but we didn't actually date till like 6 years later. So I felt like I knew him, but I didn't really know him that well. And like, and we ended up moving in together like 5 months in, because he was like living in his studio and he was already at my apartment anyway all the time. And it just seemed like wrong, but kind of it felt so right or something.
Right.
I felt like it was a bad idea, actually, you know?
You know, I almost edited this out in, because I was thinking about it, but I'm just going to go ahead and mention it. And that is that I'm talking with you about your, you know, who you are and your romantic life and whatnot. And then I'm thinking back to Soliloquy, you know, where you are putting yourself out there in the satirical way. And I'm just wondering if a prospective romantic person, a guy, you know, might be listening to this, and, you know, how you would perceive, you know, this conversation in that light. Like, would this be way too much for them to hear, you know, before you met? Or maybe is it just the right amount of, you know, healthy openness?
That's a good question. I feel like a part of me would like to feel like I don't have to hide anything. And like, if they could like hand, I mean, I have, I guess, wondered if my art can be, like, intimidating to men or something. Just knowing all this stuff up front. But I guess if someone could see it and handle it and, like, be into it, that would be nice. Like, I definitely feel like the kind of stuff I share in my work is, like, stuff I should hold back on if we were on a date or something.
Sure. Right. Yeah.
So it's a weird thing. I mean, I feel like I've gotten some like fan mail from men or something, but I've never really like, it feels awkward way to meet someone somehow.
Sure.
But I mean,
right.
If they were cool and like, I would be, if someone like was attracted to me through my work, I would be intrigued by that.
Right.
If they were cool too.
Yeah. Well, you know, I never have proclaimed this to be any kind of, dating connecting podcast, but at the same time, I would be rather intrigued myself if somebody, chose to wrote in saying, you know, hey, I'm intrigued. So.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like it happens on the, like, I've heard of it happening in other, maybe more in like celebrity kind of scenarios, but.
Right. Yeah. We're not about celebrities here. So we cover the real waterfront.
Yeah.
Well, I feel like you've been very generous with entertaining or indulging my, you know, my angles or, I don't know if probing is the right word, but certainly putting you to the task with your work and your romantic life. And so I feel like the least I can do is give you a plug for your show. So why don't you, the show coming up in June, right? You want to, I mean, we can certainly put this on the website, but for people who are only hearing it, we can at least give it to them if they're in the area.
Yeah. So it'll be at Five Car Garage with Emma Gray. I don't have an exact date yet, but
okay.
It'll be sometime in June.
Maybe mid-June?
LA, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Got it. Very good. Well, you keep me posted on that, in that information, and we can link to it.
Okay, cool.
Good. Do you have anything that we would be remiss if we didn't talk about, or do you feel like we've gotten it?
I think we've gotten it. I feel like if I brought something else, it would probably go on a while or something. But
right. Okay.
Yeah.
Good.
No, I feel good about what we covered. Definitely.
Me too. Me too. Well, Jennifer, thank you very much for talking to me.
Thank you, Michael. It was great.
Yeah, indeed. And we're out. Thank you so much again to Jennifer Sullivan. I have not had a guest on this show be more open and vulnerable, willing to be vulnerable. And I really appreciate that once again for Jennifer. Thank you. And I hope you guys got a lot out of that. For me, that's kind of what I want in a conversation is not, you know, exposure per se. It's more being able to get into heavy stuff. So I hope you enjoyed that. Wanted to remind you that this is a listener-supported show. Your support of the show is very much not only appreciated, but necessary to keep the show going. It has been moved up to once a week episodes, and that means a lot more work, and that's where your support is very much appreciated. As I've mentioned, my objective is to get a donation a week. I had 4 after the Mark Thomas Gibson episode, but I have had none since Helen Toomer. So I hope we will get back on the donation train. You can donate through theconversationpod.com quite easily. You can, of course, also support the show in other ways by leaving a nice review on iTunes, which is linked through the site, following the show on social media, Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. And spreading the word, it's very much appreciated if you like the show that you tell other people, tell your friends, get more people to listen to the show. This is a small niche, so every new listener really counts. All right, thank you so much again for listening. I hope you will spread the word about this episode in particular. I think it's a great one. I hope you do too. And I will talk to you soon. chat for now.